Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Gray Matters, discussing all things senior, produced by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, the voice of reverse mortgages and seniors, hosted by Dirk Gray. My NMLS number is 222-785. Amanda Snow's NMLS number is 1478823. New Mexico Reverse Mortgage's NMLS number is 1102656. This information is not from HUD or FHA and was not approved by HUD or a government agency. If the borrower does not meet loan obligations such as taxes and insurance, then the loan will need to be repaid. The information given during the show is not meant to be all-inclusive. Any guests on the show are not endorsed by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage. This show is brought to you by our producer, New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, helping you move forward in reverse. Our website is www.reversenm.com, and our office phone number is 505-897-4900. Today on my show, my guest is Curtis Smith. Curtis is now retired and was NMSU's Extension Horticulture Specialist and also wrote the question and answer column of Southwest Yard and Garden for 22 years. And this is the second time I've had the privilege of interviewing you, Curtis, and I'm thrilled about being able to do it again. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. And had interesting discussion with you and Amanda earlier as we looked at your hydroponics here at the office.
Yeah, she's just thrilled to have that here. And Mace, you know, you heard Amanda talking about Mace and his involvement in it. So it's kind of fun to have it here. I'm kind of an innocent bystander, but I'm learning a little bit.
You get the secondary benefits. This is positive. Secondary smoke's not good, but secondary gardening, it's not terribly bad because you get to eat something from there.
Yes, that's right. All right, Curtis, tell us about your background.
Okay. I grew up near Houston, Baytown, Texas. Mother tells a story that I was gardening when I was 18 months old because she was out pulling weeds and I was coming right behind her pulling the flowers. And so I've been doing things for a long time. I've enjoyed gardening. But went to school there in Baytown, Texas, went then to Texas A&M to get my degrees. Got a degree in botany, plant physiology, and in horticulture at Texas A&M. From there, I went to Montana State University as assistant professor of horticulture, teaching horticulture there. From there, I came to New Mexico, first as the Bernalillo County Extension Horticulture Agent for New Mexico State University, and then I was able to move up to the State Horticulture Specialist position for New Mexico State University, and that's where I retired.
And Curtis, break down those terms, horticulture, and you said another thing, so I think it started with a B.
Okay, botany? My bachelor's degree is in botany, which is the science of the study of plants.
Okay.
And back in those days, things were classified a little differently, but the reclassified things. So algae is not in the plant kingdom Planta anymore. So things have changed since I was in school. That's one of the hazards of being old. But things have changed, but it's interesting to see how those changes occur. But I studied the botany, study of plants. Plant physiology was my master's degree. That's the study of what makes a plant tick, the chemistry inside the plant, the physiological processes and things. So photosynthesis, respiration, protein synthesis, all those things, what makes the plant work. Mm-hmm. And it's important, but I really enjoyed more my doctoral course, and that was in horticulture. And that is essentially taking the science and making it work, doing things with it. In my lectures, I like to say that horticulture is to botany what engineering is to physics. You take that basic science and you put it to work, and that's what horticulture is doing, taking the science of botany and the chemistry and all the other things and putting those together and making things work, making them grow. And I enjoy gardening, so I like that, and I've enjoyed my career as a horticulturist.
That's great. Well, talk about, you said this before we came on air, you were talking about seniors, and of course this is, it's called Gray Matters, a discussion about all things senior.
I got a lot of gray up here, not so much the matter inside, but on the outside of the head is a lot of gray, what little is left.
I do too. Why is gardening important to seniors, or should it be important to seniors, I guess?
Yeah, there's really a lot of reasons that, and I probably forget some as I go through this, but... We started this with the fact that, you know, At my age, I wake up in the morning stiff and sore. As I move and do things, my body functions better. Mm-hmm. And so bending to garden, you know, I got to do what I can do. I don't want to overexert. I don't want to hurt myself. Mm-hmm. I want to use the proper equipment. So I've got kneeling pads so I don't kneel down on goat heads and things like that. But I work. Your fingers work pulling weeds. You're working the garden. You're planting things. So you're working fine muscles as well as large-scale muscles. So you're making your body work as you garden. So that keeps your body functioning. It's healthy. You're gardening to grow things. And very often, in my case, I like to grow things I eat. So I'm growing things I eat, and I know what I like, so I grow what I like. And the nutrition is high because it's fresh. It hasn't been harvested and waiting. Some things, nutrition will decrease after harvest. Other things may hold on to it for a while, but I can harvest. I'll also do my own canning, so I'll preserve, make salsa and things like that. And so I have fun and enjoyment out of this. That's the other part of it, the psychological fact of gardening. You accomplish something that's important to you and good, and you get to share. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the other things. And gardeners are some of the best sharers I've ever seen. They like to share with each other, as you saw Amanda and me talking.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it was fun to listen to you guys. Okay, when you talk about gardening and the different seasons, mm-hmm. what do you do in each of the seasons?
Okay, I'm going to talk about gardeners in general and then what I do.
Okay.
In general, gardeners garden through the summer. New Mexico summers are challenging. New Mexico gardening is challenging. It takes a little bit of knowledge beyond just the regular book learning. But by the time the summer's over, you're kind of glad to see fall get here. And by the time winter hits, you're already chomping at the bit, ready to go back to the garden. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, most gardeners I've seen, really good gardeners, are in that stage. So what I do is I garden indoors on the windowsill through the winter. The fall, when the garden comes out, and last year, the garden really didn't go out till the end of November. So I had an extra long gardening season. But at that time, then you start cleaning the garden, working the soil, but taking your garden debris and putting it into the compost.
Now, when is this, Curtis?
In the fall. We've had a frost and the plants are dead, and some plants will continue after frost. Things like kale, chard, some of the lettuce and stuff like that may go into light frost. We won't take a hard freeze. Mm-hmm. My kale has gone through the winter before. So different plants do different things. But when plants die, you want to pick them up, take them out of the garden, put them in the compost pile, and start the composting and recycle them back in to improve the soil. We really don't need to waste this valuable material in the landfill. Mm-hmm. And so we do that. And there are tricks that we don't have time to go into right here in this segment to take things that normally you wouldn't compost and be able to compost them. And so I've learned all the tricks. I've been around long enough to learn how to cheat. But then I compost. And then starting in midwinter, this year, about November, I'm going to start some of my chilies. I have some of the really hot chilies, like the Carolina Reaper and the Ghost, are really slow to set pods. So I'm figuring I need to start them very early. But then I've been fighting insects all through the winter indoors. And so I'm building a sun porch so that I can be growing plants. And in warm days, open it up so the natural predators that may be around may not be surviving outside. But I hope I get some natural predators on my sun porch so that there'd be parasitoid wasps and there'd be other things that eat the aphids that cause problems with my seedlings. So I'm growing my seedlings, then I'll move them out to a cold frame. So when the weather warms up, I can put them in the garden and get a running start at the garden, and especially those really slow-to-produce crops will have time to produce. And then I will also grow a lot of them in containers and bring them inside and grow them in the sun porch or in windowsills and be harvesting indoors through the winter.
It's fascinating to me because I'm such a novice at this. Okay, let me ask that question. When somebody is a beginning gardener, what do you suggest they do?
Start small. If you try and get too ambitious, especially those of us with the gray matter, we don't want to start something too big too quick. Let it grow. Grow the garden, and not grow the plants in the garden, but also grow the garden. Start with a small garden. Grow a little bit. Your most favorite food, if you like tomatoes or you like chilies or something, grow a few. You don't have to grow everything you need. You can go buy some more and add to it if you're going to use it in what you're cooking. Lettuce, carrots, you can grow those things. But don't start too big. And as you succeed, the feeling of accomplishment that you get from that will encourage you to expand. Well, okay, expand reasonably, and so grow it slowly.
So are you talking about you're growing in the soil? But I know last time we talked, you also suggested growing like above ground in
container gardening.
In container gardening.
Yeah, raised beds and containers. And raised beds are really good for seniors who have lost their flexibility or they're confined to wheelchairs or something, because you can still garden, get the feeling of accomplishment. So there are ways to even garden there. And again, it's small, but you can garden in a relatively small space. You can grow an awful lot if you know what you're doing. And so choose the right things and succeed.
Can you buy kits, or do you, when you say raised beds, do you build them yourself, or do you, can people go buy them?
I'm of the mind to build it myself, but you can buy them. Many of the nurseries will sell you the kits with special corners, and then you either buy the wooden slats to fit into it, or cedar or something that's not going to rot, so you can build a raised bed out of that. And again, start small, expand it, design it with the plan that you're going to make it bigger, but don't start at the full size.
It's just fascinating to me. All right, well, we've got about 20 seconds left. Anything you can say in 20 seconds?
It's fun being here, and I would like to encourage people to garden. If you've never gardened before, the Master Gardeners are here to help you. The Extension Service is here to help you, and here on the radio, we'll help you.
Well, that's great, Curtis. All right, it's time for a break. You're listening to Gray Matters, discussing all things senior, produced by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, here on 1600 AM and 93.7 FM, News Radio KIVA. I'll be back shortly. Welcome back to Gray Matters, discussing all things senior, produced by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, with your host, Dirk Gray. Gray Matters, discussing all things senior, is heard weekly on Saturdays, beginning at 10 a.m. Mountain Time, and streams to a global audience. All right, before I continue my conversation with Curtis, in our segment called Because You're a Senior, These Are Available to You, this week I want to tell you about Ace Hardware. They're offering 10% off for those 60-plus, and Albertsons is 10% off on the first Wednesday of the month. So remember to listen for Because You're a Senior, These Are Available to You. All right, I'm continuing my conversation with Curtis Smith. Curtis, let's talk about roots. You mentioned roots and how they can be an issue, and just let's explore that.
Okay, yeah, roots, because we don't see them, and we really don't want to see them. When they show up on the surface, it's not good, but we don't understand them. A lot of people have the concept that the tree roots look just like the top of the tree upside down, and that's not the case. Tree roots tend to be very shallow because roots need oxygen to absorb moisture and nutrients. The deeper you go in the soil, the less oxygen there is. So they need to be near the surface. But here in our climate, where it gets really cold in the winter near the surface and really hot in the summer, they need to be down deep enough so that they're protected from these temperature extremes. So we, by the way we care for them, by the way we water, we can help the plants put the roots where they need to be. But we've got a very shallow, wide-spreading root system. There may be a taproot. There may not be. That part can be there or not.
What does that mean, Curtis?
A taproot is a root that essentially when the seed first germinated, it grew straight down.
Okay.
Generally, it will degenerate, but in some cases, it will persist. taproot is there, but it's more for anchorage. It's not going down to absorb. It's not really going to the water table unless the water table is fairly shallow. We have to irrigate here in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And the roots, though, one of the points that is really important to understand is they grow where there is moisture. They don't grow across dry soil to get to moisture because they cannot grow in dry soil. So I had a friend tell me that they cut down a persimmon tree because they were told the roots are going to grow under their house. Well, there's no water under the house unless you've got a leak in your sewer line or your water lines or something. So there's no reason, there's no way the roots can grow under a house. Now, if you've got a good footer or stem wall around the house, they come to it, they may hit that wall and grow down, but they're not going to grow under the house unless there's water there. But they will grow alongside it. And a properly made house is going to have a foundation so that those roots cannot break that. Now, a garden wall, it may be able to knock a garden wall over. And you see it growing under and lifting the garden wall. Mm-hmm. Roots have tremendous power. It breaks concrete, breaks pavement and the roads and stuff like that. So they have the ability to break things. but going under a house is not likely, unless you've got a leak, and then they're telling you you've got a problem.
Well, okay, let me ask you this. When you water a tree, what's the proper way to water a tree?
It's going to depend a little bit on the soil. Different soils hold different amounts of water. Sandy soil holds little water. The water just runs right through it. Clay soil holds a lot, but it's hard to get the water into a clay soil. So the soils are going to affect how you do it. But the real important points are you put the water where you've got the roots that are the little tiny absorptive roots. Those big roots that you see aren't absorbing. They're just pipes carrying the water collected by the little tiny roots. Well, those absorptive roots are most found where the water is, and that's going to be beyond the drip line of the tree. Drip line of the tree is where the water drips off the edges, so that'd be the point where the tree harvests water. So it's going to have a lot of roots, absorptive roots, in the drip line area, but also out beyond that.
It's so like a circle around the tree.
It's like one of the analogies I use when I'm teaching is that in a mature tree, water the donut and not the donut hole. The donut hole is that area from the drip line in, and the donut then is from the drip line out. And how far out depends on the size of the tree and how much you own and you can afford to water. But you have to, for a large tree, you've got a large, wide donut that you need to provide the water. And there are some tricks that we can use for that. But the key is putting the water where those absorptive roots are so they can absorb it, bring it back in. And the majority of the roots are in the top 1 foot of the soil. The majority of absorptive tree roots from the top 1 foot. Some will be down as deep as 3 feet. Depending on the type of tree.
You mean the absorptive?
The absorptive roots. Now, you've got structural roots and anchor roots that will be deeper if the soil permits it. If you're on caliche, they won't be down below that. Mm-hmm. But the absorptive roots are the ones you really got to take care of to take care of the tree. And they're going to be watered. So when you irrigate in that donut area, water anywhere from 2 to 3 feet deep fairly consistently. You don't want to always water exactly the same depth because you'll accumulate salts that are in our water at that point and cause some problems. So sometimes you want to water deeper to flush those salts below. But what you want to do is water in there and have a consistent area where those roots don't dry out and die. And nut trees, oak trees, and things like that tend to have roots down to about 3 feet. An apple may use 3 feet of soil, whereas a pear may use 2 feet of soil. Which means it's good for a raised bed.
Okay, so if you're watering and it's an average size tree, mm-hmm. whatever that means, how long would it take you to water that tree?
It will depend on the soil. Like mm-hmm. I said, clay is very slow to receive the water. You water very slowly for a long duration. The key here is find out how water for, say, an hour or 2 hours. Probe the soil and let it have some time to soak in. Then probe, either with a metal rod, a sharpshooter, a long, narrow spade. See how deeply the soil got moist. And if it's only moist for 6 inches, okay, I need to water 4 times, 6 times longer, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so you can get a reading on how your soil works with the water at the way you water it. And then you can then water according to that.
So if you don't water enough, mm-hmm. do the roots tend to come up to that water?
If you water frequently and shallowly, the roots will have to be at the surface, mm-hmm. which is not the best place for them.
That makes sense, though.
Mm-hmm. And if you water deeply and infrequently, letting the surface dry, that's going to encourage the roots to be down deeper where they are more protected from the environment.
Okay.
And where they will actually find more nutrients and stuff. And the key is to get them spread out once they stand up against the wind. The more widespreading your root system, the stronger the tree is against wind, and the more nutrients and water they have to retrieve. They're over a larger area.
Okay. It's fascinating. All right. Let's talk about organic.
Aha.
That's one of the hot topics these days. So what do you think?
Okay. First off, full disclosure, I like to grow things organically, but I am not totally organic. I will use other methods when necessary. Some people may prefer just to go ahead and take the crop out. So your choice depends on your feelings. A lot of concern is lack of knowledge about what these are doing. And there is some concern. Some things that I've taught are safe. I'm hearing people say they're not. I think it's misuse of them, but I need to look at it more. But in most cases, plants don't absorb the large molecules of some of these pesticides and things, so it doesn't get into the plant. It's on the surface. It can be washed off. Now, root crops that are in the presence of whatever's in the soil, you may have to skin it, peel it, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these chemicals are not absorbed into the plant. Some are systemic, and they are absorbed. You need to know what you're using. I like to use things like neem oil. It's from the neem tree in India. In India, they use the neem branches for toothbrushes. So it's not toxic. So it's a very low toxicity, mammalian toxicity, yet it's toxic to insects. And so it can be used to kill insects. It's also different forms of fungicidal. So it can kill fungi. And so these are things that are good to use. And knowing something like neem is good, it just doesn't work on everything. Mm-hmm. In my indoor garden in the winter, when starting my seedlings, the aphids come in. They cause a lot of problems. I'll use neem. It tends to cause yellowing of the leaves. It affects the plant slightly. So I rotate, and it's always good to rotate your control methods. But I'll go to a synthetic pyrethroid, which is not organic. It is low mammalian toxicity, but it can cause skin reactions and stuff like that. There are some other things it's accused of. So you don't want to be inhaling it. You don't want to drink it and things like that. But these are on seedlings, so it's not going to be persistent in the plants later on. I can then rotate back and forth. I will use insecticidal soap sometimes. Some people are allergic to soap, so they may have a problem with the soap. But it is effective at killing insects, but none of these are 100%. And so I'm constantly and having to be vigilant and persistent to control things.
But, okay, well... You know, I hear people talk about organic. What's the definition of that?
In gardening, the definition is actually governmentally determined. They're government and then some non-government organizations that have also formed to regulate and certify organics. The term organic in chemistry means something that contains carbon and hydrogen. That includes oil, petroleum, which, you know, organic gardeners don't particularly want. Mm-hmm. But so in chemistry, the word organic is something else. In gardening, it means you're not using synthetic fertilizers, insecticides. They will use botanical insecticides and things like that, but they may not use certain other things that are synthesized. Botanical means it's extracted from another plant. There are, depending on the certifying agency, some things that would be rejected by another one are accepted by one. Mm-hmm. And so the definition is a little bit variable depending
kind of fluid.
On who certifies.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. How strict you want to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That makes sense. All right. Well, it's time to take a break. You're listening to Gray Matters, discussing all things senior, produced by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, with your host, Dirk Gray. I'll be back shortly. Welcome back to Gray Matters, discussing all things senior, produced by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, with your host, Dirk Gray. Gray Matters is heard weekly on Saturdays, beginning at 10 a.m. Mountain Time, and streams to a global audience. All right, I'm continuing my conversation with Curtis Smith. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and look forward to doing this again, Curtis, at some point.
I do, too.
Okay, let's talk about poinsettias.
Okay.
And, you mean, you know, during the break, you talked about all kinds of things, but what are your recommendations for that plant?
Okay. Some people like the challenge of buying a poinsettia, carrying it through the year, and reblooming it the next year. And it is a challenge. Your first challenge is just getting it through the winter, keeping it cool, properly watered, not overwatered, but not drying out. So you keep those red bracts or the colorful bracts. Those are really leaves that turn color. The little flowers are insignificant, but the bracts don't form unless the flowers are forming. So in order to rebloom it, you're going to have to grow the plant through the winter. You carry it through the spring, summer, and into the fall. And then in the fall, you're going to induce it to flower again, and it takes very special conditions to get the flowers to form, because it's what's known as a short day, which is more accurately said a long night plant. It has to have long nights to flower. It flowers in the winter when the nights are long. And so the key, just watering it, pruning it, stuff through the summer. NMSU has a publication on growing poinsettias, so you can get that through your county agent. And then once you get to the autumnal equinox, so September 22nd this year, So we're past that. But that's when the nights become longer than the days. At that point, or earlier if you wanted to, you begin the induction process where you induce flowering. You do that by taking the plant. You're going to have it indoors so the frost doesn't get it. While it's outside, it's okay. It's under short days, long nights now anyway. But you bring it indoors, put it in the window. Inside a house, we tend to turn the lights on. That interrupts that night period and will prevent the flowering or delay the flowering at the very best. So what you do is you'll pick it up, put it into a closet where you're not going to open the door. Leave it there all night, bring it back out the next day. Don't leave it there until Christmas, but take it in and out, water it as it needs watering, but put it in the dark for a long period, at least from sunset to sunrise, longer if you wish. But you've got to get those long nights. That will then stimulate the chemical changes within the plant so that those buds turn into flower buds, which will then cause those bracts to start turning red. The sunlight is necessary for getting that good color development. Now, there's yellow ones and other colors as well, but they all require that long night treatment. And the ideal is keep temperatures cool as well. Cool just keeps them healthier. Not freezing, but dropping down to 50 at night is good. If you can't get your house that cool, that's fine. If you got a cool room, that's good. Just don't turn the lights on. Don't let it see light. If it's in a window and a car drives by and a light shines in, some plants are so sensitive, that would be enough to delay the flowering. Just a car driving by and the light flashing through a window. And if it happens every night, it will really delay things. Or a street lamp shining in the window can delay flowering. And as I told you, I had a Christmas cactus that flowers under long night conditions, winter conditions as well. These are native to the tropical regions, so they won't take freezing. So they can't be outside, but they're also native to the Andes Mountains, so up at high elevation where it does get cool. Mm-hmm. And so they're induced to flower under cool night, long night conditions. I had one in my office many years ago. It was sitting in the windowsill. Well, the custodians came in at night, turned the lights on to clean the office, and then they turned the lights off and leave. Well, they interrupted that long night. But one of the stems... In a Christmas cactus, those things that look like leaves are really stems, flattened stems. That stem was leaning against the window. In the winter, it was cold outside, so that window was cold. And that one stem flowered because it was induced by the cool temperatures, even though the night had been interrupted. The rest of the plant didn't flower. But that Christmas cactus did flower on one stem because it was cool. So by combining the night length, the dark night period, and the coolness, we can enhance the flowering.
Okay, that makes me think of a couple of other questions. If you're a novice like I am, are there plants that you would definitely avoid just because they're so high maintenance?
Those that, you know, the key here, I'm being a gardener, I encourage people to do things. But try it. If it doesn't work, maybe you want to avoid it for a little while, but be challenged to come back to it. Mm-hmm. For most people, for a poinsettia, the simple thing to do is just go buy one every year.
Uh-huh.
But some people get that challenge. They want to make it bloom again.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never be as pretty as the one you bought, the one that was grown in a greenhouse. But it'll be yours, that sense of accomplishment, and that's worth something. Another one, one of the stories I like to tell, Dr. Paul Boslin at New Mexico State University, he was known for the Texas-New Mexico Chili War.
Mm-hmm.
How to spell chili? New Mexico has the E and Texas has the I.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, and Texas was trying, you know, Texas has a bunch of good farmers and stuff. They were trying to grow chilies. They tend to grow jalapenos.
Uh-huh.
And so that's Tex-Mex more jalapeno than New Mexico, not mm-hmm. the New Mexico style. But Dr. Boslin and chili breeding really began at New Mexico State University. And so we take pride in that here. Even though I'm from Texas, I'll take pride with the New Mexicans. And he was doing that battle, but he also created a new war, the Chili Poinsettia War.
And what is that?
Okay. Very often, most places you buy poinsettias as Christmas decoration, but he has bred ornamental chilies. He always advises they're hot. And so they're not bred so much for flavor, they're bred to produce colorful pods and to have a branching pattern that makes the plants compact, to make them good indoor plants for windowsills and good for holiday decorations. Some of the first ones he bred were for Christmas pod production, but he's got others for Valentine's, for Memorial Day, for Halloween, different colors and things like that. So he bred a bunch of ornamental chilies, and we can use those. And a poinsettia you can't eat, and a chili you can.
That's interesting. It's amazing what people come up with.
Yeah, so it's just funny. So New Mexico tends to pick a battle every once in a while.
Okay, let's talk about what you're doing now. And I know I want to talk about your blog, so let's get into that as well.
Okay.
But when did you retire formally?
Okay, officially I retired, depending on my appointment was both a little bit USDA and a little bit I was always NMSU, but there was some of my retirement USDA. So one of those was October 31st, 2010, and the other one was November 1st, 2010. So right there at the in October, November 2010, I retired. But then I continued writing newspaper columns and helping until they filled my position completely, and they've hired two people to fill my position. So it is now fully covered,
staffed.
And that's good, and I'm friends with the people who have filled it in, so, you know, And I try not to step on their toes, though. They're going to be themselves, they're going to be them, they're not me, but I'll help them, I'll advise them, and they make their own choices.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Dr. Marissa Thompson yesterday, and she is the urban horticulture specialist now. She's going to be great, and so...
That's nice. It's nice to be able to say that.
And she was helping me start my blog.
Mm-hmm.
Had talked to someone about starting a blog. That person kind of ran into some difficulties, and I haven't been able to contact that person.
Mm-hmm.
So Marissa is trying to help me. She's not a professional at this, but she does know how to blog. So we were working on that yesterday, and so I'm trying to start a blog, Southwest Garden Smith. And I've reserved .com, .info, .net, and a whole bunch of stuff, SW Garden Smith and SW Yard and Garden.
What's the purpose for the blog? You just want to educate people?
I think it's because I'm so used to doing this, I just kind of keep doing it. I'm here because I enjoy doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun. I like to encourage people to garden. I like to see them succeed, and so I just want, and I like the friends I've made through gardening. And this is a way to stay in contact with a lot of my friends.
Yeah, it keeps you engaged.
Yeah, and again. Mm-hmm. If you're not doing something, you're going to go downhill.
Yeah, I think so too. And totally
so
agree.
I want to stay active. And so hopefully the Southwest Garden Smith is not posted yet. I was hoping to have it up by now, but because of my other person's difficulties, I'm hoping to have it up within a month or so.
And good.
So hopefully I'll be able to communicate with some folks that way.
Is I know that you wrote articles in, what was it, Southwest Yard and Garden?
Southwest Yard. That was the TV show that we did with New Mexico State University. The newspaper column used to be called Yard and Garden, but when we did the Southwest Yard and Garden TV, they just kind of changed that to Southwest Yard and Garden, too. The newspaper column had been begun by Jim Seiss. He was county agent before me, several before me, and then state horticulturist, and then actually an administrator with NMSU. He just passed away last spring, and he was one of my mentors, and so I wanted to maintain his Yard and Garden column. And
well,
so
Jim, you may know this, but Jim was on the show right before mine on KKOB.
Oh, yeah.
So I saw him almost every other weekend or so.
He was a good friend.
Quite a man. Is the blog going to be general in scope?
I'm going to try. I'm going to focus Southwest, but since I get to go on mission trips to Hungary and Ukraine and things like that, I'm going to throw some pictures of stuff. I took pictures of some fabulous gardens and stuff in Ukraine last summer. And I'm looking forward to sharing some of that. So I'll be putting a lot of pictures in there and talking about gardening. There will be a way to communicate with me. I hope I'll be able to answer questions, but probably not as well. You know, I'm retired, so I won't be as intense as I used to be on answering.
Well,
what I'm trying to do is collect and then answer them in the blog collectively.
Yeah. Enjoy it.
Yes.
Yeah, you've earned that, Curtis.
Well, thank you.
Okay, what else can we talk about for maybe 30 seconds?
The other thing I do is I have the privilege of teaching at Wayland Baptist University. I'm teaching biology right now. In the spring, I'll be teaching environmental science. It teaches night classes. I teach 4 hours one night a week. So we're trying to fit the schedule of the students who are working people, mostly adults. I've had older as well as younger people in there, and it's fun to teach.
That's great. Well, thank you for being on the show, Curtis. I thoroughly enjoyed you. It's time for a break. You're listening to Gray Matters, discussing all things senior, produced by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage. Our phone number is 897-4900. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Gray Matters, discussing all things senior, produced by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, with your host, Dirk Gray. In our last segment, I'm talking with Amanda Snow from New Mexico Reverse Mortgage. Amanda's a loan officer. And we're going to discuss repairs and the reverse mortgage, and Amanda is actually going to be interviewing me.
Yes, Dirk. Hi, everybody. My name is Amanda Snow, and I am going to be turning the tables today and asking Dirk some questions. He also works with me at New Mexico Reverse Mortgage and is a loan officer also. So today, we're going to talk about repairs, but first, let's get a little bit of background on you, Dirk. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm glad you asked. All right. I've been in New Mexico since I was in fourth grade. I met my best friend, Richie, in fourth grade when we moved here. I've been in mortgage lending since 1989, so about 30 years. I'm really enjoying being a part of reverse mortgages and seniors, and it's been an honor and a thrill to work with you and the reverse team here at New Mexico Reverse Mortgage.
Great, great. So we're going to discuss repairs, and there is quite a lot of confusion about which repairs need to be done and when they need to be done, etc. So perhaps you could clarify that for us a little.
Okay. There is a lot of confusion about home repairs when somebody's considering a reverse mortgage, and hopefully our discussion will clarify what repairs are needed and how they're handled.
Okay, so maybe my first question is, who decides what needs to be repaired and when?
Okay, good question. Properties need to meet minimum standards for health, safety, and marketability, and that's a HUD requirement. It's just with every FHA loan that you do, those are requirements. And during the underwriting process, the underwriter will determine what repairs are required based on the appraisal. So the underwriter, you know, they review everything we submit. So they'll look at credit, they'll look at assets, they'll look at collateral, like the appraisal, and then they'll determine what repairs are actually needed and when you can do those repairs.
Okay. So why would anything need to be repaired before closing?
Okay. Well, as I just mentioned, the underwriter is going to determine what repairs are required and when they're needed or when they need to be completed. Examples of repairs that would need to be done prior to closing, I'll just go through a small list with you. So, again, these are repairs completed before we close.
Okay.
A leaking roof. A defective smoke or carbon monoxide detector when required by the jurisdiction. And to tell you the truth, I'm not so sure that jurisdiction is really going to matter to the underwriter. I think if that shows up on an appraisal, I think they're going to require that it be done prior to closing. A water heater strapped down when required by the jurisdiction. Again, broken windows, foundation cracks, and settlement required by the structural engineer would need to be done before closing. Upper level deck with no railing. We recently had that with one of our clients. Upper level door with no deck, stairs, etc. An attic or crawl space access. That's another one we had recently. One of our clients had a crawl space, and the access to the crawl space was hard to access, so that needed to be done before. An empty pool, the same borrower. She had an empty pool in her house, so that needed to be taken care of before closing. She ended up cleaning the pool and filling it up with water. Bare exposed wood on the exterior of the property, exterior peeling, pre-1978 paint where children are living in the property, that's just due to the lead paint issue. Well and septic distances that do not meet guidelines would have to be done prior to closing. So those are just some examples.
So to me, Dirk, it sounds like most of these address safety issues. I mean, if you don't have railings up on a balcony, or you have a door opening onto nothing, or, you know, you have a well that's, a pool that someone can fall into, these are obviously safety concerns. And then the other thing is the integrity of the building. If you've got a leaking roof, or you could have, you can't check the crawl space and check that it has foundation issues, or, you know, it doesn't have smoke alarms. They've got to obviously protect the integrity of the building, because that's what they're using as collateral.
Yes, exactly, Amanda. You're right on the money.
Okay. So what kind of repairs then could you set aside money to repair after closing?
Let's go over a list.
Okay.
Okay. So repairs that can be set aside, and we're going to talk a little bit more about what a set aside is in a few minutes, but roof at the end of its useful life, less than 2 years, and is not leaking, can be set aside. Connection to public water or sewer if the existing system meets FHA requirements. Flashing on the chimney. Major peeling post 1978. Again, that's the lead paint based time frame. A second unoccupied and gutted unit, provided it's valued only as storage in the original appraisal report and the county does not recognize the unit as living space. That can be used in a set-aside. And then bath remodels or fixtures that require repairs when there's more than one bathroom.
So these things are things that then could be postponed. You could see that they're not going to affect the structure or integrity of the building, and they're not a safety hazard. It's just, well, we kind of need a new roof, and so let's put some money aside for that. And, you know, we'd like to clean up a old abandoned structure or whatever. It's something that's not sort of critical to do it immediately.
Exactly. That's okay. Exactly right. And the repair set aside, let's talk about the repair set aside just for a minute. If it's a smaller amount, like $500 to maybe $1,000, something like that, it's 1.5 times the amount that's required. So if it's $1,000, we'd set aside $1,500. On larger amounts, it's 2 times to establish the set aside.
And they hold this money out at closing?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And then what happens if you do the repairs? Well, let me ask you questions. Who, first of all, determines who does the repairs?
Well, again, that's the underwriter. An underwriter will specify if it's something that needs to be done prior to closing or if it's something that we can establish a set-aside for.
And how does the homeowner pick who does the repairs?
Well, the appraiser is going to require that something be done. The homeowner is going to hire the contractor, and they normally have to be licensed. I mean, you and I were talking off air, and you said, well, something like, what did you mention? Was it peeling paint?
Yeah, can you have somebody just paint some paint? But you're right. I believe that if it's something that's, you know, electrical, plumbing, roof, it has to be done by a licensed contractor.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, and so the homeowner picks the person to do the work, and then if it's done prior to closing, how does the underwriter know it's been done?
The appraiser will go back out and make sure that it was done properly and sign off on it.
Okay, and if they do the work after closing, how do they get the monies back from the set-aside?
Well, again, it'll be inspected to make sure it's done properly. And then the money will be transferred into the line of credit of the borrower.
Okay. And if there are funds left over when the repairs are completed?
Okay. That's same thing. Let's say that there was $5,000 set aside and $4,000 of it was spent. $1,000 will be transferred into the borrower's reverse mortgage into their line of credit. All right, I just want to clarify on the repair set-aside. Normally, the borrower pays the contractor that does the work, and then the monies being held in escrow are deposited back into the borrower's line of credit. Make sense, Amanda?
Yeah, so they're reimbursed after they've paid the contractor.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Yep. So let me ask you another question. What happens if the structural integrity of the home is questioned?
Okay, in that case, there are related inspections and repairs that must be done prior to closing. A structural engineering report or related inspections may be required too. They're going to be required.
Okay, got it. So let me see if I understand this correctly. Essentially, you have an appraisal done, and then the underwriter decides what repairs are needed and whether they're needed prior to closing or after closing. If they're needed prior to closing, the borrower pays for them and takes care of it, and the appraiser comes out and reinspects. If they're after closing, there is a repair set aside put aside, and then once this loan has closed, the borrower is responsible for hiring a contractor. They normally pay for it, and then they get reimbursed from the set aside, and the money is put into their line of credit. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's great, Amanda.
Oh, well, you've clarified it for me.
I couldn't do that off the top of my head.
you clarified it. Good job, Dirk. Okay, well, thank you. All right, so hopefully you guys understand about repairs, and certainly if you contact us, we can give you a list of repairs that are normally needed ahead of time or ones that can wait till after the closing. So, Dirk, why don't we chat a little bit about the process of what happens when someone calls into our office?
Okay, I think that's a great idea. You want to go first?
Well, I'm just thinking, so the listener out there knows what to expect when they phone in. Normally we greet you. We will ask you a few questions. First, we'd like to know what you're looking for, what you hope to achieve by getting a reverse mortgage, and how we can help you. We'd like to ask some questions to see if they would be eligible. And after we've determined that they could probably qualify for a reverse mortgage, we like to set up a meeting so we can have a one-on-one and really get to know the client and get to understand their needs better.
You know what? Let's drill down a little bit on what you talked about. Like, what are some of the specific questions that, like, there's a couple of things that drive almost everything we do. The value of the property.
Right. You have to know the value of the property. If they own it free and clear, then they would probably qualify. If they have a loan, we have to know how big the loan is and how much equity they have left. Because if there is not very much equity, they probably won't qualify, unfortunately. So, and we determine how much equity they need by their age. So we need to know their age. So those three pieces of information, the value of the property, the amount of the loan, and their age are integral pieces of information we have to understand if they could qualify.
And the age is the youngest borrower on title, right?
Correct. Correct.
Okay. What about credit?
Well, we do have a financial assessment that went into place about 2 years ago with the reverse mortgage, and it's not quite as stringent as when people go for forward mortgages. We like to make sure that they will be able to maintain a certain standard of living, be able to pay their taxes and insurance, you know, enough money to do all of that. We also want to check that they don't have liens and judgments against them. So we look at their income and we do pull a credit report, but it's not as if they have to have a set score or set debt ratio as you do with other types of loans.
But I think it's important that they know if their property taxes or their homeowner's insurance has been late in the last 24 months, we may have to do what's called a LISA, a life expectancy set aside. So because that'd be an FHA requirement or HUD requirement. So the investor knows that those things are being paid in a timely manner, similar to an escrow account.
Exactly. So with a LISA, the life expectancy set aside, taxes and insurance are put aside so that the borrower doesn't have to pay them themselves. They are paid for automatically by the lender. And that way the lender is assured, just as you said, with regular forward mortgages, when they put it into an escrow, they're assured that they're paid in a timely fashion.
Yeah. And you know something, we've had cases where the borrowers say, you know what, I'd like for you to set up the LISA so I don't have to worry about making those payments.
Oh, yes. We've actually had borrowers who've asked, who've said, please, we would like to do this. Then we have to worry about nothing because we don't have principal and interest payments with a reverse mortgage. And if we set aside their taxes and insurance, they don't have to worry about any payments to do with the property. They just need to keep it maintained in a decent condition, you know.
And the appointment that Amanda was referring to, after we have the initial conversation, we'll have you come in for what we call it a reverse mortgage 101. And it takes about an hour and a half.
Yeah, we like to go over in quite a bit of detail what a reverse mortgage is and the expectations, and explain to the borrower what they're getting into, different options available to them, make sure they thoroughly understand it, and we give them some literature to take home. We run some numbers specific to them, and then we let them go home and think about it because it's, you know, a lot to take in, and we want them to be very comfortable with the decision they're making, and we like them to try and include family members or people that they might want to confide in so that everyone's on board, you know, with their decision.
Okay, great. Well, we're done for the day, Amanda.
Well, it was fun asking you questions, Dirk. Thank you for having me on.
All right. I want to thank Curtis Smith and Amanda Snow for being my guests on the show. I also want to thank my KIVA team for making Gray Matters Discussing All Things Senior, produced by New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, your favorite place for all things senior, reverse mortgages, and you, our audience, for joining today's broadcast. Thank you for listening to New Mexico Reverse Mortgage, the voice of reverse mortgages and seniors in New Mexico. If you'd like to call, the office number is 505-897-4900. Thanks for joining me. I'm Dirk Ray.